Reiterate that it's great to have the parents with us. A, for parents to experience what their sons have been learning. And B, as JJ said so beautifully before, okay, one of the things we do in Yeshiva is continue this great conversation that our people have been having for a couple thousand years. And it's good for, you know, fathers, mothers, and children to be part of that conversation together. Okay, so we're going to do kind of an interesting topic here. It's a topic I've not given before. Okay, so I had to put it together for this year. What place does romantic love in halacha? And I think we think about marriage, obviously there could be various motivations for marriage. You might imagine maybe different societies would think about it differently. Like someone could obviously get married for money, that would be one possibility. Maybe one could conceive of marriage as a vehicle for producing children, right, for continuity. And obviously those are both factors that are separate from like finding your soulmate per se. And then there'd be, of course, a more romantic conception where you're looking for your soulmate. So though, I realize there could be more possibilities, but let's start with those three. And one might have thought that maybe in the old world, you wouldn't have category three so much. Because you could argue a lot of differences, right? If people don't live as long and they're getting married earlier, you might think about it differently. If you live in a world where it doesn't have easy transportation and your marriage prospects are limited, who lives in your small Polish town? Right, that could also make you think about it differently. So again, you might have thought that this kind of more romantic conception would just be a recent phenomenon, but we will check if that's true. Okay, to put it more bluntly, maybe think that Pumpedita did not have its Upper West Side or its Katamon. Okay, but let's see if that's really true. Okay, so let's see as we go here. Okay, see, I just got a nod from someone who once lived on the Upper West Side there. Okay, so let's see what we have here in source one. Okay, well, source one will start a bit slowly, then we'll see, I think, more powerful examples as we go along. Okay, so this is a Gemara in Kiddushin that many people in the room saw during this year. Right, you can't get married unless you've seen her. Right, even in the world of arranged marriages, you might think at that point, he's in one town, she's in the other town, there'd be no need for them to meet. Apparently, it's halachically problematic. Right, they can't get married unless there's one meeting. Shema Yereba Davar Maguna. Okay, maybe he'll find something that's not so likable about her. V'titkenelov. And why is that a problem? V'achman Amar v'haftler reyecha kamocha. You're supposed to love people. And I guess among the people you're supposed to love is your spouse, not so surprisingly. Good. And therefore it would be problematic to engage in a marriage when you haven't seen each other. It's kind of interesting. Even today, even in the most Hasidic circles you could think of, where it's really not much of a choice of the children, there's always some meeting, right, based on this Gemara. There's always one case where at least the Chatan and Kala meet somewhere first. In fact, I'm going to tell a joke that nobody's going to get, but I'm going to tell it anyway. Okay, they used to say, how come in Hasidic circles in New York, right, it's three dates and then they get engaged? Well, the answer was because there are three airports. Okay, I'm not explaining it, but okay. Okay, but I guess some people got it. Okay, but, okay. I see Mr. Gnells is explaining it to his sons. Very nice. Okay, so that is the halakha. Now, I admit, you could be a little bit more narrow about this. In theory, someone could say, this is all about physical appearance, just make sure that the person is not ugly or repulsive to you. But I don't know if one has to be narrow about it. It's not so clear what the gnai would be. There could be aspects of character as well. But here again, I guess, point one, right, there is a halachic demand that the chatan and kala have to have some encounter beforehand, okay, to make sure that they think it's appropriate. Okay, let's keep going. Now we get another halacha that would work along similar lines. Dami Yudamarav, Itim Rabbi Lazar, Asur Ladam Shiekadesh Bito Kishik Tana. Right, you can't marry off your child when she is a minor, even though it could be technically you have the ability to, but Rav was very against it. Anchetikadel Vatomiponia Nirotza. And clearly, what's the factor here? It's clear what he says. What are we waiting for? Her to be adult enough to indicate her desire. So we seem to really care. No, she should want to be on it. She's coerced into it. It's not going to be good. She'll grow up and say, why did my father pick this guy out for me? He's really not the person I want to be married to. That's not going to lead to good things. Better to wait. So I also point out, you notice we have now one in both directions, right? The first source focused on the husband seeing the wife before the marriage. And the second source focuses on the girl as a katana not being married off at a minor age. Because it's not a good idea when she gets up. When she grows older, she might not be happy. So it definitely seems to be like the first inklings of we really want the chatan and kala to actually want to be with the other person, and that's part of marriage. Okay. Let us go perhaps to the negative, though. What about other kinds of motivations? So let's go to the Gemara in Kiddushin in the second source. Okay. Amar Rabbi Rav Huna, kolanose isha she'eina hogenet lo. If you marry a woman who's not, how do you guys translate hagun?
Fitting.
Yeah, fitting or appropriate. But in modern Hebrew, if someone's hagun, it means they're upright, they have integrity. Okay, maleva katuv kilu charsho l'kolam kolo v'zaro melach. Kind of interesting imagery. You plowed the whole world and planted it with salt. Presumably this is not good for vegetation, right? To plow the whole world and plant it with salt. And therefore, it's a negative imagery. Okay, so there's a problem to marry. Okay, Sam, very loyal student. Okay, so there's a problem to marry someone who's not hogenelo. Now, what does it mean not hogenelo? Now, in theory, you could have said, you know, not appropriate, you know, one's vegetarian, one's a carnivore. Okay, however, if you look at Rashi, how does Rashi translate in hogenelo? What did Rashi say there? Psulalo. What does it sound like? Not just, it's not a great match, but she's actually halakhically forbidden to you. Like maybe you're marrying your ex-sister-in-law or something like that. Right? So that would be much more narrow and restricted. Get someone who's possible for you, which could also impact on the next line. Let's look at the next line. Amra bavad amrav kalanosa isha l'shum mamon. If you marry a woman for her money, havilo banim she'enem uhuganim. It's not a good idea. Your children will not turn out upright. It's not a good move. She'enem, as the pasuk says, Bahashem Bagdu, you were traitors to God, ki banim zarim yaladu, and you gave birth to, this is a phrase that might be important as we go along, banim zarim. Somehow if you marry the spouse just for money, what happens? There's something problem with the children. The children are strange, as it were. Okay, so this seems to be a great Gemara for those of us who don't like the mercenary approach to marriage. Right, here we seem to have a harsh criticism on those that marry just for money. Okay, great. However, I have to, even though I identify that very much, I want to be as intellectually honest as possible. We're going to see that there are two ways to take that Gemara, a much more narrow way and a much more expansive way. And the difference is quite interesting. For example, if one goes again to Rashi, right, the classic commentary on Chas, what does Rashi say on Banim Zarim? What are his first three words there? Meisha psulalo ulashem mamon nasva. How does Rashi take the case? You're marrying, who are you marrying for money? A woman who's actually not allowed to you, right? That's what you're doing. You married a woman who's not allowed to you. Again, let's say it's your ex-sister-in-law, and she's very wealthy, and that's why you're marrying her. But what might emerge from Rashi, though? This whole problem of marrying for money was really describing only when you're technically violating somebody by marrying. But that might mean, if she's as long as she's technically mutter to you, you wouldn't have that kind of negativity in the Gemara. So that would really restrict this criticism about marrying for money. Okay? We're going to talk about that, but that, admittedly, that's what Rashi seems to do. And maybe it fits in the larger context of the sugya, because larger context of the sugya, with Isha Ogenetlo, Rashi also took us about Isha Psulalo. By the way, what might work in the, if you wanted to argue for Rashi, in terms of the Gemara's phraseology or the pasuk cited, is there anything that might help a little bit? Try to bring a proof for Rashi, whether you like the pshat or not. Any support you could bring? What about the pasuk? What do you think about that pasuk that's quoted? Yeah, Simon?
No, I was saying maybe if they're Bani Mzarim, it means that they're coming from and not from.
Ah, very good. Question is, how much do you build on that phrase, Bani Mzarim? Like, what makes the children, as it were, strange? So one possibility is that maybe it's actually their halakhic status is affected because you married somebody who's apostle to you. I think, it's an absolute proof, but maybe Rashi would jump on that, that the phrase Bani Mzarim. Yeah?
I thought you were going to say that Bagdu, like, the trade is more of a, marry someone for money that's not betraying Hashem.
Oh, very good. Right, you're saying that maybe Bagdu indicates there's a concrete halakhic violation there.
Yeah.
John Segal, very good. It might be a better argument than my argument. Excellent, John. Okay, yeah. Uri.
According to Rashi, like, what would be the chiddush of like adding the dimension of like it's for mamon and she's possible?
Ah, that is a great question. I've got to relook at the question. But I think I'm going to convert your question into a strength. It's always this key move, right? Just make the question into an answer. Okay, so Uri says, wait, but if you're doing halakhic violation, who cares what your motivation is, right? Who cares what you're doing for monetary reasons or, you know, lust reasons or any other reason? So, Uri, maybe the answer is we do care, right? It's not only a question, does someone violate one of our principles? It's also interesting to explore why someone violates a principle. It's kind of interesting if someone is so mercenary that, oh, I know this is wrong, but it's worth it for money. And maybe for certain motivations, we'll have a little bit of sympathy, and for other motivations, we'll have more sympathy, and some motivations, we'll have no sympathy. So maybe it's like a sharp point here. You could violate this principle for a bunch of reasons, but we're really upset if you violate it just for, you know, cold cash, right? That's a really lousy reason to violate this principle.
Well, I'm saying why would we ever think it's okay?
Like no, it's not. It's not that it's okay. It's like there's a particular harshness dedicated towards someone who does it purely on monetary grounds.
suppose, but like if we already learned out from the fact that she's just puzzle, then like it's like kavuchomer to puzzle and mumble. So like it seems like the added.
Okay, so I'll throw some else in, guys. We'll do a little Tanakh tangent, okay? Our first tangent of this year, Coley. Okay, I was once in a shiur given by Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, and he had a very, very sharp idea. Okay, in the Bilam story, okay, who tends to be the bad guy of the story in our tradition? Bilam. So Rav Moshe said, well, why isn't Balak the bad guy of the story? Right, Balak hires Bilam to curse Am Yisrael. So maybe Balak should be the bad guy. Okay, so he said, I think, a very profound idea. What motivates Balak and what motivates Bilam? So what motivates Balak in the story? What does he say explicitly? He's afraid. Why is he afraid? Right? This new nation is moving into his turf. This new nation seems to be pretty forceful, and he doesn't know what it's going to be. He's afraid they're going to be swallowed up. They're just going to be decimated by the Jewish people. Okay? What motivates Bilam?
Money.
So Rav Moshe said, you know, it's not that it's good what Balak does, but on a certain level you can understand when someone who's frightened lashes out. But someone who's just a mercenary character, right, there's no ideals involved, it's just, I'll do anything for money, that's something that's particularly pernicious. So maybe, Uri, maybe that's what our Gemara is saying here also. But obviously, forbidden marriages are problematic. But when you do it just for the cash, there's something particularly pernicious about it. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Things are red. It creates a child who rebels against his parents because he doesn't see love. He doesn't see.
Okay, good, good. Okay, you see, that might be shot in wide. Sorry. Okay, we'll get back to you in 1 second. Excellent. Okay, everybody good so far? Okay, so let us see perhaps a more expanded version. Okay, by the way, I'd just like to assure everybody that Eitan Galper is going to run out of the Shabbos. It's going to be okay. Okay. And his roommate, the mayor of Englewood, is currently in Italy somewhere. Please. Okay, that's roommate is. Whatever. Chabrutami. Okay, let's go to the morale in source four. Okay. Okay, now if I have the pants, I have no idea what's going on there, but okay. Okay, now the morale wrote a very nice commentary on the Agadic sections of Shabbos. It's good to realize. Like, you look at different mefarshim for the legal sections and for the non-legal sections. So for the non-legal sections, the two most famous mefarshim tend to be the Marsha and the Maharal. Okay, so let's see what the Maharal says. He has a separate four-volume work called the Kedusha Agadot. What's the problem of Banim Sheinim Muganim? This is one other thing, by the Maharal's terminology is not so easy. Sometimes you have to fight through it, but it's worth it. Having the Banim Sheinim Muganim, Perish Rivnei Ki Abanim Im Toldon Im Shachim Echibra Aveim, oh, here you go. When you're thinking about money, very nice. What's his first approach? What are you doing? What's Eruv Davar Zar? You're mixing in a foreign element, you might say. Right? You don't understand what it's about, right? Oh, you think marriage is about money? Right, that is a strange element. It's something that shouldn't be part of the mix that is being brought in from the outside. And getting back to what you suggested, Mr. Gahan, so that might be back to the Pasuk. What's the Pasuk say? Banim Zarim. What's the Banim Zarim? Because you brought an element that doesn't really belong there. When you bring an element that doesn't really belong, it creates an estrangement, right, which has implications for the next generation as well. By the way, according to the Maharal, does it sound like he's on Rashi's team or not on Rashi's team? No, not at all. Does his explanation, is that limited to a woman who's puzzle and a union that can't work out? Not at all. So I would say we go back to the expansive reading. I'll get to comments in 1 second. And this is a pretty big split. Like Rashi again has the narrow reading. Oh, only if it's a forbidden woman, that's what's being criticized. Doesn't sound like there's such negativity to marrying for money. Where the Maharal's explanation makes a universal principle. Right? You're bringing in foreign elements that don't really belong there. Yeah, Jacob.
So I'm just curious. He's saying money is the foreign elements of marriage. The two primary actions within marriage, like
okay, so first of all, ketubah is not what makes the marriage, it's something that accompanies marriage. So, okay, I'll say it this way, Jacob. Even if you are a big idealist, right, and you would like to downplay money as a motivating factor in the world, it's hard to, like, totally ignore economic reality, right? And if you're concerned that the husband's going to divorce the wife and she won't have a means of support, so I think Chazal has to address that, right? So they address that by making the ketubah. That doesn't mean that a wedding is all about money, but I think what it means is you can't ignore that there are economic implications to different actions in the world. Okay, Jacob, I know you're a big idealist. I like to be an idealist also. Okay, even though all the parents are here, I'm going to tell everybody to major in humanities. Okay, but nonetheless, it's okay to have some economic concerns in life. That's okay. Okay, the ketubah is addressing some important economic concerns. Yeah.
Do you think
think in the same way where if the choice we have so far that you wouldn't really be able to marry for money or very, very frowned upon, if the idea of marrying for money would be there's some sort of benefit for you, you live an easy life. If you want to marry someone who for some reason is very poor, would you not do that either?
Oh, we say, what if you're the rich person? And you want
to, if you're the rich person, or you want to see the other side, you want to be involved with the side, or you just don't want to have to worry about money at all, but you're marrying them for the sake because they're poor.
Wait, you're specifically picking a poor person to marry?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think, I'm tempted to say that Shiloh's never been asked in Jewish history. Wait, so just to understand, why is question?
Or really, by extension, if you're not allowed to marry, if the idea is you shouldn't marry for money, is that
I mean, you're saying you should oh, that's a cute question. I mean, one way to say it is economic consideration should not play any role, and therefore it's equally problematic to pick someone who's poor.
Even marry someone who's just...
Yeah, that's pretty clever. I still think the simple shot in the Gemara is that we're more nervous about someone being very mercenary about it, and that would not apply in your scenario. Okay, so if I ever ask that question, Josh, I think I'm going to say it's okay, but I'll worry about it when the question comes forward. Okay? Yeah, Alex.
Are we applying a double standard here? Meaning, like, we're talking about this case in the context of, like, a man marrying a woman for her money, but are we...
Okay, look, there's an interesting question. It's an important question lurking through this whole sugya, which is, to what degree it goes both ways. I'm going to leave it aside for now, if that's okay. Okay, anyway, if you want to discuss women's issues, just go to Rev Dovin's morning share. You'll do it endlessly. Okay, but maybe at the end we'll talk about it a little bit. Yeah.
I don't know if it's specifically here we're just talking about the money, or but it seems to be putting an emphasis on the actual relationship part of the marriage is really important. By that aspect, would a marriage based on a politics, like, would that be...
Okay, so you're right. You're saying there are other options out there besides what I've said. Like, I only had three options: money, raising children, or romantic love.
Right.
Okay, so it's a good question.
Like, you're doing it for, like,
it's a good question. Hang in for now. Okay, Jake, give me 2 minutes. Okay, let's go to the Maral's second shot. That was the Maral's first shot. What is his second shot? So I think it's very, very beautiful, actually, the second shot. I'm now after the ellipsis on the fourth line. We have the idea of God being especially arranged in marriages. Okay, anybody who says that? May Hashem yatsa davar? Ooh, tough one. Breshit chav dalet. Okay, excellent. Okay, guys, JJ Kahn from others now ineligible to give any more answers. Okay, we're kicking her out. She has to go to the mirror. Okay, excellent. Okay, it's true. That's the negotiation between Eved Avram with Rivka's family. She's absolutely correct. Okay, the Ita Bebreshit Rab Beparshit Vayetze Matzino Betorah Benevim V'Ktuvim Kizibo Gadam Yashem. God's involved in matching people. Kamosha Yachsham. Now comes a very beautiful line. The Ein Lecha Mili Deshmaya Kamo Mishinosa Isha. So there's something heavenly about it. Okay? The idea of God being involved in marriage, according to this, gets an added layer. It's not just about divine providence. It's given like a heavenly tint to marriage. What does that mean? Ra'ui shiel l'shem shemayim. Once there's something holy about it, what goes together? Holiness should go with idealistic motivations. And he has a great analogy. Ra'amru sha'asar limkor sefer tarkim lisa isha. Ki mashino se isha gam ken shem shemayim v'dush yish b'zeh. Ah. And then just one more quote in Pesachim. Kotve sefer to tefillin mezuzot einem rom simon bracha lo olam. Ki mili deshmaya v'hem dvarim kdoshim emo sim lit asher einem simon bracha. He says a very powerful idea. What's the problem? We don't want to take things of great sanctity and make them a pragmatic goal towards cash. Like, imagine if you... So it's interesting because it's tricky because we need those professions. But nevertheless, there's something funny about it. Like, let's say you're a sofer. It's an important profession, right? Jews need Sifrei Torah, they need tefillin. But what if you're in it just for the cash? Then there's something a little bit funny about it. Like, here you have, he's involved in Kedusha, but it's really just this money-making operation. Where else, even though he doesn't mention it, where else did this idea come up in Halacha? What other profession might be problematic?
Teaching Torah.
Yeah, teaching Torah. Right? What I do might be problematic. Right? There are ideas in the Gemara about maybe Torah should not be a means of fundraising. It should not be a means of supporting yourself. And they're kind of these interesting, heterim that are kind of a little funny, some of the weird heterim. Maybe I'm not being paid for my Torah teaching.
What you could have done.
I'm being paid for what I could have done. Or what's one of the other versions? I'm paid for, like, the non-Torah aspects. Maybe I'm only paid for the jokes. Right? That's why I try to tell so many jokes. Right? To justify my salary. Right? But I think there's a powerful idea here. the idea that like holy things are not meant to be means of finance. So that works out beautifully. What's he saying? If you appreciated the sanctity of marriage, you would realize how inappropriate it is to turn it into a, you know, cash-producing initiative. One second, did everyone got that? So just to sum up where we are so far, what have we done? We have this criticism of marriage for cash. Again, Rashi with his narrow reading, only when you're violating a prohibition. And the Maharal with his expansive reading. And again, he had two layers. What was his first layer? You're bringing in Davar Zar. It's an extraneous factor. And his second reading, which I really liked, it's about turning something holy into a mundane endeavor. Okay, David Zweck.
So let's say somebody is getting, they're getting married to Shei Mamon, but they want to use the Mamon for Dvar Kedusha. Would Maharal then hold it? It's okay or no?
It's a clever question. I still think the answer is no, actually. Because even though you're using money for Kedusha, you're not recognizing the sanctity of the marriage, per se. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, even if you're buying Sifrei Torah as a result, right, but you still distorted what the Kedushin is. Right? So I can't see how that would help.
But can you say that, you know, if you're selling the Sifrei Torah, right, but you're...
Right, you hear me, David?
Yeah, I hear you.
Because also, I think Judaism does not have a fully utilitarian ethic, mm-hmm. right? There, some things could be wrong even if they produce good results. Yeah?
Would you be allowed to only date wealthy girls but then pick the one you like?
Okay. Oh, these guys, we have such clever Talmudic students here, all right? That's amazing. Okay. We'll get back to them later, okay? All right, yeah, Simon.
Do you see sources in here that said that married love the time?
Okay, but no. Okay, let me clarify one thing. I assume L'Shem Mamon. No, it's not the same thing. There it was. It's the only chance for them to get married at all. Right? You understand what I'm saying, Simon?
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, I'm not going to explain it because it'll take a while.
Yeah.
Okay, but you understood the answer?
Thanks.
Okay, we'll talk about it afterward. Okay, let's see how this plays out. Give me 2 seconds, Eddie. Okay. Let's go to source 5. So what I'm going to do? Look this up in Shulchan Aruch. So it's interesting, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, you're going to see there's a little bit of a tension. It's not so clear which way Shulchan Aruch goes with this issue. Okay, let's start. Lo yisa adam isha sheish ba shum pisul. Haga, what does Ramosh Islis write here in Krakow? Kola nose isha psula mishum mamon, havelo banim she'enim uganim. If we stop right here, whose team is the Raman? Is he on the Rashi team or the Maharal team? Clear the Rashi team. What does he say is problematic? To marry a woman who is pasul for cash. So he sounds like he's on the Rashi team. If it's not so clear, he's even more explicit. And this is going to be important. Who does he quote? It's a tshuva from the Rivash. If we get to, I hope we'll get to it. The Rivash is a fascinating tshuva about this topic. Okay, so if we stop right here, Rav Moshe Islis is clearly on the Rashi side of the divide. Look what happens as we go along here. What if your future in-laws promised you a lot of cash? Right, you were the yeshiva star, and they came and said, we'll give you a lot of money to marry our daughter. V'chazru b'hem. And what'd they do? Oh, guys, see, just don't fight about money. It's just not worth it in life. And they retracted. All of a sudden, the hundreds of thousands of dollars they promised you don't exist. Lo ye'agen kalato mishumze. Lo ye'agen? Don't make reservoir. What does it remind you of? Very good. Don't make her an aguna. Right? No, it's not a reason to hold back. No, get married to her anyway. Mishum ze v'lo yitkotate b'avur nichse ishto. Guys, it's worth it to come this whole year just to get this line. Let's lo yitkotate. Don't fight. There's so many family fights about money and it's never worth it. Right? Lo yitkotate b'avur nichse ishto. U'misha osa kein, if you do this, eno matzliach, you're not going to succeed in life. Ve'en zivugo ola yafa, you're not going to have a good marriage. Okay, let's turn the page. The money that a man gets together with his wife, eino mamon shel yosher. It's not money that is honest or just. And if you do that, it's like you're getting married. Wait, what happened? What does it sound like now? Who does he sound like? Doesn't he sound more like the Maharal now? So what's going on? First he tells me it's only if you're marrying a woman who's halakhically problematic, if it's only a problematic union. And now it sounds like any fighting about money is a really good idea. Just look, he quotes here, it's Beit Yosef Mishum Orchot Chaim. Okay, so first he quoted the Rivash, now he quotes Orchot Chaim. So the question is, should we try to reconcile it or not? So I always find it interesting in the world of thought, that almost like two kinds of thinkers out there, that those that like Machloket and those that don't like Machloket. So thinkers that don't like machloket are always trying to reconcile everybody. I'll show you how really Rashi and Ramban say the same thing. Right? That's one impulse. I have to admit I have the exact opposite impulse. I don't know, maybe I'm just the mean guy. I like machloket. No, I actually just think it's truer to life. Like, people argue, it's okay. It's not a crisis. Okay, so let's see. Should we try to reconcile it all? Or should we say that not everybody's on the same team? You know, there was 1 year in a Raita, we had like a leadership program for guys who were in Kol, a little bit older. So I taught them once a week. So it was a really interesting guy who was really, he was like that. Anyway, no matter what machloket I taught, he explained why I was really happy he was on the same side. It was really, really frustrating. Okay, so guess what? There's a real irony, right? So then I would argue with him. But then he had explained why I was on his side. Okay, so let's go. So let's go to the Chelkat Machoket. Okay, so how do we deal with these, with these two themes? So he says, V'chola osake and mikri nose. I don't understand. You told me before it's only if it's pasul, only if it's a forbidden union. How come you're expanding it as the piece goes along? It says, Hainu im no lo mamun baratzon tov. If everybody gets along, that's fine. Okay, money's part of the world. We all get along. It's not a problem, even if there's monetary incentives and considerations. Of la'agen kalato b'shvilzeh. But to break up a marriage, so he kind of navigates it. What is the Ramah saying? There's two things that are problematic. Don't marry someone who's invalid for you because of money, and don't break up a marriage because of monetary considerations. But if it's not a pasul, and everyone's beretzon tov, everyone's getting along about it, that's perfectly fine. Okay, so I admit, in this case, it does work. The Chelkat Machlokes approach would, in fact, reconcile disparate themes here, and you can work out a theory. Okay, the Gra, on the other hand, was on the other side here. Okay, the Vilna Gaon. Where's Jacob Rocklin? Jacob Rocklin, Vilna Gaon, your favorite. You even dressed up nicely for the Vilna Gaon in your clothes today. Either that or your dad. There are two possibilities. Okay. So what do you have in the Gra? Kiamamon. Vizeu de lo kirivash on Yiskalel. What does it say about the later part? The latter part does not go together with the rivash. The ayin chelkat mechokek, I mean, the Gra knows the chelkat mechokek tries to reconcile the two themes. There's aval haikar, but the real thing is the svil or chachayim techol mishamamon have legamke no say. What has the Gra want to take it? No, these teams are not reconcilable. The Rivash is on the Rashi team, which is only when it's pasul, and the or chachayim is on the other team, right on the Maral team, which means any marriage for money. So just to sum up, if we take questions and move on, we now have the Rashi now reading, the Maral expansive reading, the Ramah had almost contradictory themes, the Chelkat Machlokes tries to reconcile the contradictory themes, and the Gra says, stop trying to reconcile, there's simply a debate running through halakhic history. Zevi, what do you want to say before?
So when the Maral says that bringing money into a marriage is like adding in a Devar Zar,
mm-hmm.
So what does he see marriage as? Because I feel like you could say so many things are Devar Zar to bring into a relationship.
Okay, that's a good question. Like, you're right, in theory, even if you restrict things to my three principles, you could still go either way, right? The Maral could say marriage is really about finding your soulmate and this romantic love. Or you could say, you know, marriage is this great social arrangement that enables the production of more Jewish children. I admit, you could say both of those things and still say that Mammon is a Devar Zar. You're right, he hasn't said exactly what it's meant to be. Although I will say one thing, though. He did talk about it, certainly the second piece, as something kadosh. So it would be hard to say at that point it's not money, but it's something else pragmatic, right? I think you get to the same problem. It's hard, right? You see what I'm saying? Like, let's say someone says, "Oh, I know the Maral. He's really, you know, mean to women." You know what he thinks? It's not about money. It's about somebody like cook you dinner every night. That's what it's about. I don't think that would fit with his terminology, right? He said it's about some kadosh that shouldn't be translated into the mundane. So whatever it is, it's something related to sanctity.
So could you argue that according to the Maral, physical attraction?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Oh, that's a clever question. I think I'm going to duck it for now, although it's a really good question. Okay. Look, I'm tempted. No, I don't do it. It's like a whole other shiur it'll come out in now. It's a great question, but I'm going to duck it. Sorry. Okay. Good? Everyone good? Maybe I'll do it at the end. We'll see if we have a little time. Ezra Blatt.
Can someone marry someone else? Off, like a daughter or a husband, can they get married off for the parents for the sake of money?
Meaning the parents are getting money, but not the child.
Yeah.
Okay, but the child, don't forget, the child has to make a choice, right? We saw it in the first Gemara. Right. Ultimately, if the child doesn't agree to marriage, it's...
Yeah, they have a different reason, but the parents, like, condone the marriage just for the sake of...
Okay, we'll get to parent-child in the last 10 minutes, okay?
Okay.
All right, let's sneak in one more. John Katzman.
Would you say the Maharal contradicts the sources we learned last week, that, that Kedushin itself is not a mitzvah, it's rather it's to get the fruit or do?
That's a very good question. So just to clarify, those who weren't here last week, there's a debate among our commentaries, is the only mitzvah reproduction, fruvu, and kiddushin is just the means, or is kiddushin a mitzvah per se? So it's a very good point, John. I certainly would say, if you say kiddushin a mitzvah per se, the maral works better. It certainly works better. Okay, I'm not sure it can't be worked out the other way, but I think, you know, there are plenty of Rishonim who think that kiddushin is a mitzvah per se. Okay, great. Let's go to the next halacha. Okay, this is a difficult halacha, and no one's allowed to leave shir early, okay? Because if you leave shir early, you're not going to realize how halachic history played out. Okay, so even if you're bored, just hang out until 1 o'clock. Okay, let's see Yivamot here. Nasa Isha Vishayim, I'm in source 8. Esther Shinim Lo Yoda. You got married 10 years, unfortunately. You don't have children, right? It's a tragic thing. Eino Rishai Levatel. You're not permitted to negate. Now, I realize it's a little bit unclear in the source here, but what would you be negating?
Puruvu.
So, no, but you have a mitzvah. You're supposed to produce children. Apparently, this woman might be barren. So, let's see what happens. It gets harsher as it goes along. Taner Rabbanan. Nasa Isha Vishayim Esther Shinim Lo Yoda. Yotzi v'yitein ktuba. So what do? You get divorced. Now, there is one thing. We do try to support the woman here, right? She gets her ktuba. We don't say, oh, you're at fault. You don't get your ktuba. But it seems pretty harsh that you divorce the woman and marry somebody else. Shema lo zochal yibanot mimena. Afal pi shein rai ledav zeich ledavar. Very famous source. Miketz esar shenim l'shevedam beretz Kanaan. Okay, when does Sarai come up with the initiative that Avram should be with Hagar? Because it is. It's interesting, by the way. In the Pesukim, it's clearly not an Avram initiative. If you look at the Pesukim, it's totally Sarai. She is the one pushing it. She's the one even says that she takes Hagar and brings her to Avraham. But what is it chronologically? 10 years after they've gone to Canaan. So what's the idea? Lamdecha she'ein yeshivat chutz l'aretz ola lo menanyan. Ah, here's all the Zionist passionate fanatics here. What's the claim? Wait, they've been married more than 10 years. Because they were married back in Haran or Kastim. So what's the claim? Nah, those years don't count. Right? Only get to Israel do you start the clock running. So then from 75 to 85 is 10 years. At that point, now we decide that Sarai's barren and we have to look for another solution for Avram to have offspring. Okay. Now the B'nai Gemara goes on to say, Lafika chalahu o shechaltahi, if either one of them was sick, o shneim chavushim bebeit asurim, or they were both in jail, Ain olim lo min aminyan. But that last line is quite important. What does it seem to indicate? Even if 10 years passes, if there's anything we could have to kind of explain why they're not having children, to explain the infertility, we do so. And once we have an extraneous explanation, what emerges? There's no reason to encourage them to get divorced. Understand what just happened? Right, just like we use the Eretz Yisrael card, we say illness would be the same thing, and time in jail would also be the same thing. Now, I'm not going to read it inside, but the Aruch HaShulchan says something quite fascinating. How do you guys understand the jail case? Where are they exactly? Are they like in separate wings of the prison, like the male side and the female side? If that's true, what's the obvious point? Then presumably at that point, like, it would not be a sign of infertility. Okay, it would be okay. Okay, in fact, all right, I really shouldn't do this, but it's just such a good line to tell. Sorry. Rosh Hashiva should not tell jokes like this, but I'm going to tell it anyway. Okay, so my wife has a friend who, when she was in Colombia, she was really sick one day, and she went to campus health services. And, you know, if you're a college student and you're not feeling well, so they're going to start to ask you questions, assuming that maybe you're pregnant, okay, so if you're female. Okay, so they kept asking her questions. Maybe you're pregnant, and she kept saying, it can't be, right, for obvious reasons. So, but they kept bugging her. So finally, my wife's friend couldn't take it anymore. So she said to the nurse, listen, lady, if I'm pregnant, they're going to start a new religion after me. Okay. Okay. That was a pretty good one. Okay. So, here, presumably if they are in, what must be the case? They're in prison together. So then wait, if they're in prison together, why does prison change anything? Shouldn't that be a sign of infertility? Isn't that, does anyone notice this point? So what does the Aruch HaShulchan say? Look at the end of the fourth line. It's quite fascinating. Mikom akom, Tolin Miniyat Hirayon, what's to be toles something? We hang it on the fact that we're pregnant. Bifnei Dagat Beit Asurim. What's going on here? It's not a physical impediment. It's emotional, right? Maybe given the psychological state of being in prison, prison's not a happy place to be, that's what's getting in the way of the fertility. So I think that even expands the idea, and the Aruch HaShulchan says this, right? Already there's kind of a leniency built into this halakha. It seems like after 10 years it's all over. No, but if you could come up with some reason why, well, no, this was not, the first 10 years weren't an adequate test case, right? Somebody was sick, you weren't living in the right land, right? There was some kind of psychological barrier, impediment getting in the way, then the halakha is neutralized. Yes? Jeremy.
I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure the Gemara was written before they limited it to one wife. So why does it specify they have to be a divorce?
So in fact, you're absolutely right. Jeremy, look at Rashi on source 9. Rashi on source 9 has two options. What are the two options? Either divorce or marry another woman. But I'm not going to get into it right now. There's too many good things I want to discuss now. But even Gemara times, they realize that two wives usually doesn't work out well. So some of the reason why you go with the divorce card is assuming that it's not going to be a happy situation if he's married to two women. Okay, so even if technically you can, the Gemara understood it's usually a bad idea. Yeah, David?
Why would Rashi even give that option if he lived after a Sajidon?
Because he's explaining the Gemara.
Okay.
Yeah, we're good? Okay, Greg.
Isn't there a much more logical way to get out of the jail thing other than it's a psychological...
What's your logical way? No, but if they weren't trying to have kids, it's obviously not a source for infertility. Like, what's the chiddush? Right? We're saying even though they were together for 10 years, there's no grounds for divorce. So if they weren't trying to have kids, so then the whole thing, the question doesn't get off the ground. Right? The whole point is, even though they were trying, he was sick. Oh, even though they were trying, she was sick. Or even though they were trying, something about the prison life was getting in the way. No, but again, I think at that point there's nothing to discuss. Right? If you're not trying to have kids, it's not surprising you can have kids.
Exactly. So do they have to...
Why would there be a law if they have to be divorced then? The whole point of the divorce would be... this. We think they're infertile and we want to encourage peer review.
So are we forcing this guy to do peer review in general, even if he doesn't want to have kids?
I see. But does a law have a category if someone refuses to have children? Okay, so that's an interesting question. There was one person like that in Halacha. Who is that one person? I think it's Ben Azai, right? Very good, John. Very good. Okay, it's actually quite interesting. I've made this point in the past that Judaism, even though if you're a religion, you're kind of, I know it's a funny thing to say, but you're kind of tempted to hold up celibacy as an ideal, right? Maybe there's something a bit untoward about sexual life and dedicate yourself solely to God. It's quite interesting. There's almost like no source in history of Judaism that's in favor of celibacy. This does not seem to be something our religion's in favor of. So the one thing you could say is that there was a Talmudic scholar named Ben Azai, if I recall correctly, and Ben Azai said, I just love learning Torah so much, I can't be distracted by domestic responsibilities, and he refused to get married. So he's the one source. But I will point out, I don't think Chazal are in favor of that. I think they're critical of him. Okay, so I think we're not such in favor of that position. Yeah. Yeah, according to Midrash, but I would say it's after you already had kids. So it's not really a fair example. Yeah.
What would be the case where a couple adopt two kids, but then over the course of time, let's say 10 years, they can't have kids of their own?
Adoption's a great question. I'm going to get into right now. Okay, guys, Daniel, just give me a few minutes. I want to make sure I get at least one more source in. Okay, let's go to source 11. I know it's a really long source, guys. We're just going to pick out a few pieces. Okay, so the Rivash is from Yitzchak Bar Sheshet. He lived in Spain in the late 1300s, early 1400s, and he has the most fascinating Jew here. Okay, I'm sorry?
Spanish Rishon.
He is a Spanish Rishon. Where's Meir Tolchin? Okay, there you go. Excellent. Okay, so I'm just going to explain the case outside. I hope some of you got to it. There was a fellow in the community who was marrying a 90-year-old woman. Okay, and I guess he was much younger. He was still capable of having children, and he had never had children. So the community, you know, as communities tend to be, they were quite critical of this fellow. Okay, what did they say to this guy? Why are you marrying the 90-year-old woman? What do you think they accused him of? Yeah, you like her cash. I should have added that. She was a very wealthy woman. Okay, so here you have, I'll make up it. Let's say he's 53. So they say that 53-year-old man marrying a 90-year-old woman who's wealthy, clearly it is just for the cash value, and therefore they wanted to object. Okay? So the Rivash goes through a long tshuva, And it's very fascinating because if you look at the third page, there's a big split between the first big paragraph and the second big paragraph. In the first big paragraph, he basically says, no, halakhically, you should be right. We do have sources against marrying for money. We had that source in Kiddushin. We do have this idea that if you're married for 10 years and no children are produced, you should look elsewhere. So he says, all the more so if you're not even married yet and you're entering a marriage that is clearly not going to produce children. He says, it's true, if I stop right here in strict halakha, I should get in the way of the marriage. Okay, and now comes the greatest shift of the day here, guys. Look to the second paragraph. It starts with Amnam. Amnam kol zeh shurat hadin, lufiya gemara. What's that line getting at? It's true, that is the strict letter of the law. Of Amman na'aseh, what can we do? Shelo ra'inu b'yameinu, we never saw it. Lo shamanu mikam adarot, beitin sheniskak lezeh lachuf ulahotzi isha b'sheshata imbal eser shonim b'lo yolda. Oh, she's a getter. That's quite fascinating. What happened over the course of Jewish history? It's almost like Am Yisrael voted with their feet. Okay, what was the vote? Or rabbis voted with their feet. What was the vote? We don't break up marriages. Right? It doesn't matter. He said, I've never seen that practice. Even if the couple's married for 10 years and they don't have children. So again, don't think this is like some modern shift. Here in the 1300s, he's already saying for several generations, we never had anybody do that. We simply don't do that. Okay, even though you could say that might be the technical reading of the Gemara, says that is not what we do. And then he says something very nice about why not. See, if you skip down to the fifth line, Chabot Kulam, V'rov ha'nashim habo b'yamim ha'yotzev v'no l'ktuva v'nedunya, V'leka ktuva d'lo ramu b'tigra. You know what that means? Leka ktuva d'lo ramu b'tigra. There's no ktuva that doesn't have. Tigra means strife or quarrel. What happens in life when you divide up money? Unfortunately, dividing up money tends to go with arguments and family fighting. V'tirbra haktata v'hamariva. And then there'll be, so we just don't want to break up marriages, it's not a good thing. I mean, he happens to focus specifically on the monetary fighting that would result as a result of this. But I think we could say in a much broader sense, v'lezeh helimu chach mehadord eneihem b'ninei hazivugan, shelo lemanam. So therefore, what is the position of sages for generations? What's to be ma'alim eneihem, as it were? Yeah, what's something ne'alam? It's missing. So basically, what do they do if you're now helimu eneihem? What would be a contemporary English idiom for that? Yeah, you look up, turn a blind eye, or look the other way. Right, so it's law. So again, you could say technically in halacha, really we should be encouraging divorce. That is not rabbinic practice for hundreds of years. Okay, we simply say, okay, they want to stay married, let them stay married. Okay, so that's first of all you should realize, I think it's quite fascinating. Now, the Rivash does at the end, maybe to help the heter here, he does say, look at the last two lines, he does go with Rashi. He tries to limit the problem of marrying for money. But for our purposes, the main point of Rivash is halacha did move away from that direction. It moved away from forcing a breakup of marriage, which I would say is a certain legal recognition of the value of, you know, loyalty. You married a person for 10 years, this is not something we should be quick to try to break up, even if unfortunately they're not producing children. One more idea though, guys. Okay, this is for you, for the pragmatists among us. Maybe you thought this year was too idealistic, not enough pragmatism. Okay, so go back to the line that begins with V'nikshu. V'nikshu al mishpat. Okay, see that line? It's about 8 lines up. What about this specific case? Look what he says. V'lachin b'nidon shelefneichem. The case in front of you. Imaz kenahi, this elderly woman. Nichala. Nichala. She's okay. Delayed v'kala shma d'ishur, she should be married. V'shiela habal b'makom ben. Very interesting. What does she want? Yeah, she'd like a child to take care of. She doesn't have one, so she'll have a husband. Chutra liyada. Okay, this is a Talmudic phrase. She'll have a staff at her hand to support her. Umara lakvura. And a hoe to dig her grave. Meaning, she wants someone to take care of her. Umatza zeh shirotza lisa'enem b'fnei dochko. And she found this guy wants to marry her b'fnei dochko because of his dochak. What will be his dochak? Yeah, but in this context, yeah, his pressure, proving he just fell under economic pressure, he's under difficulty. So he goes, okay, that's not a terrible thing. So I think it's quite interesting also, again, I'm a big idealist, I really don't like the idea of a mercenary marriage for money, but you could imagine a specific context where it's an arrangement that really services both parties. So the Rivash says, that's what's going on over here. Right, you have a 90-year-old woman who's no take care of her, you have this 54-year-old guy who's impoverished. Okay, you're right, it's not the most romantic. You know, we won't make a Hollywood movie out of it, right? The birds won't be chirping and the sun shining in the background. But it's still, it's a good arrangement for the two of them. So don't be so negative about it. Because before I take comments, we have the Rivash, again, saying that halakhic practice is not to demand divorce after 10 years. And in this specific context, he says, maybe pragmatic considerations have their place. Okay, who wanted to ask a question before? Didn't turn their hand up? We're good? Yeah, Jacob Glassman.
I was wondering, we like kind of established that the divorce is not mandatory in practice, but if the husband still wants to give a divorce, does the wife have to accept it if he has those remedies?
So the truth is, I think she would have to accept it, but realize we're kind of makeable about grounds for divorce in general these days.
Right?
Meaning, they also could each just say, I don't like my husband. Right? It's an interesting question. What would a rabbi do? Would a rabbi try to talk him out of it at that point? That's a good question, but not for us right now. Okay? Anybody else with questions? Yeah, three.
Do you think this hints at all like towards romanticism and love, or is the top part like just about loyalty and the bottom just mutual benefit? Like once you're already married, then like, you stay married because different monetary issues and the bottom part because they both need something.
Right. Look, you could make a split between loyalty and romance if you wanted to. Not sure they're totally on other sides of the island. But I would view them both, though, as about the real personal connection between the two of them as opposed to some kind of pragmatic arrangement. So for my purposes, I'm going to blur the distinction out between loyalty and romance. Is that okay? Maybe romance needs more loyalty and loyalty needs more romance. Yeah, Daniel.
If someone's married for 9 years trying for a kid and then they stop trying to get for like 2 years, and then they restart again, does the clock reset or does it go back from where you were?
That's a clever question. I would guess it doesn't reset, but that's, I don't know. That's a clever question. I have to look it up. Yeah.
Can you clarify what you meant by pragmatic reasons?
Okay. In marriage or in life?
In marriage.
Okay. Let us say you were doing it because you want money. That's a pragmatic reason.
So you think that it does have some place. You can't totally outrule it.
Well, in this particular case, okay, you could ask whether it has a place in general. I think the case the Rivash is doing is almost like an unusual case where I think many people would be sympathetic to it, right? Which might mean that context really matters. Again, you have a 9-year-old woman who's looking to be taken care of and a 50-year-old fellow who's impoverished. So maybe in that context, right, you feel differently about that kind of motivation. Okay, you're right. What about in general is a good question. Yeah, David.
Why does this couple require a marriage in order to have a relationship?
What else should they do? That's an interesting question. I think it's often, what if they want to live together in the same house?
People have caretakers.
I think you could think of various psychological or legal reasons why this would be better, but it's an interesting question. Yeah, Art.
I was just going to say that, isn't that a Chama Leibowitz story that she married your uncle?
There is such a legend. I'm not sure, it's not entirely clear why she married him. Nachum Leibowitz married an uncle who was like 25 years older than her. So one version of the story is that she did it because she wanted to just take care of him, and the truth is they didn't. They never had children. But I believe she claimed that she just loved him. You can read, there are two good biographies of Nachum Leibowitz. One in English by Yael Unterman, and one in Hebrew by a woman, Chiyuta Deutsch. They're both very good. Yeah.
When do we choose to take halacha from the God sections of the
Torah? That is a great question, but I am not going to deal with the next 4 minutes. Okay, we're good? Okay, one last source, guys. This is the greatest source for parent-child weekend. Okay? Yeah, Dave Brooke.
We didn't know this morning about adoption.
Yeah, I'm purposely not discussing adoption because it's just going to take us too far afield. There's a lot of good side questions here, which I'm sorry I can't deal with. Just maybe next week. Okay? All right. The Marik, Rav Yosef Klun of Italy, was asked, guys, parents, you might be disappointed in a second. Was asked, does kibra of aim apply to choice of spouse? Right? What if your son wants to marry somebody and you object? Right? Can you play the kibra of aim card? Okay, so the new good news for this children is that he says no. Right? It is not something where kibra of aim applies. Right? And he's got three reasons why not. Okay? And what's important for us is the middle reason. Maybe in the interest of time, I'll do it outside. If you want to look at source 12. Okay, what is his middle reason? It's quite fascinating. He says that, well, we certainly believe in taking care of parents in Judaism and respect and reverence for parents. At the same time, there are limits, like anything else. Your parent can't tell you to do the wrong thing. If your parent tells you to steal or to be Michal Shabbos, you don't have to listen to them. Right? Like, it makes sense. There'd be limitations on parental authority. Okay, but now he makes a really creative move. Some of you heard this from me earlier this year. He says, wait, what did the first Kohen Kedushin say? A husband should meet his wife first because we want to make sure that they're appropriate. They're going to love each other. So he says, wait, but that means it's a rabbinic value, it's a Torah value, that the husband and wife should love each other. But if your parent forces you not to marry the person you want to marry, what does that mean? As it were, they're getting in the way of that loving relationship. But that's a Torah value. But I admit, it's funny, because it's not like a concrete prohibition. It's not like, oh, they're telling you to be Mechal Shabbos, they're telling you to kill somebody, God forbid. But he says it's still getting in the way of a Torah value, and therefore it's not an area where Kibud Aim applies. So I would say, for me, this is one final source, kind of moving towards a more romantic conception of love, in the sense that, ultimately, who's the only person who can make the choice about what the right loving relationship is going to be? Only the young couple. Right? It's not an arena where the parents have the authority, the jurisdiction to step in. I'll take the last comment in 1 second. Okay, so now I think we've established at least a couple of themes moving towards romantic, or if you want to use the word loyalty, conception of marriage. Okay, remember we said they have to meet each other first. Don't marry off your daughter when she's a minor. She has to grow up and say, this is the person I want to be married to. Okay, we had criticism of getting married for money. Again, Rashi in a narrow sense, the moral in a very broad sense. Something sanctified is going on. If you make it a mercenary affair, it's not sanctified anymore. Then we had what seems to work against this, the 10-year halacha. The 10-year halacha seems to be much more about producing children. That's what it's all about. And therefore, if you're not fertile after 10 years, get divorced. But notice what the Rivash said. What happened as Jewish history progressed? Okay, the rabbis basically voted against that halacha. It is not put into practice, and we do not force people to get divorced after 10 years, which again, I think might be a move back towards this more loyal, romantic, interpersonal conception of marriage. And finally, with Maruk adding the sense that it's not a choice of the parents, because really only the person knows who they love. So I think if you wanted to have a shiur about where we do find this more romantic conception of love in halakhic sources, I think we've found that they really do exist. John?
You claim that even if your parents are adamant against you marrying someone, if you go against the Kibud Aim, and totally destroy your relationship with your parents, it will work because you can, when you marry your spouse, you can do Kibud Aim for her parents, and you typically will be, you typically do Kibud Aim for her parents. So if you can't do Kibud Aim for your parents anymore,
I don't think it works, Johnny. It's a cute argument because it's true you have Kibud Aim to your spouse's parents, but that doesn't like come in place of Kibud Aim to your own parents. Right. It's not like find some parental figure somewhere and be mechabed them, right? It's these, right?
Part of the family.
It's a creative spur, John, but I believe it's incorrect. Yeah, Ezra.
But don't parents have an obligation to make sure their kids get married and to help their kids?
Okay. Why is that contradicting this idea?
Well, no, but wouldn't that put a lot of pressure on the parents to find... So maybe beforehand, to find a person for the child, could I look at money for...
Well, that gets... Oh, your question from before, can the parents think money?
The reason why I have this question is because when the slave of Abraham, who we claim is Eliezer, goes, he says... So the first thing he says in Parsha Kayasara is about Abraham having money to the other parents, to the parents. The first thing he references is Abraham is very wealthy. God has given him a lot. He has
last year. So let me just close one last story. Because I feel a little badly. David, I'll take it afterward. I don't want to feel, if anyone's from a wealthy home, I feel like they might feel like they've been put down in this year. Okay, so look at the Gra in Source 7. Okay? The Gra has an idea. It's an important idea, although it might be tricky in practice. I didn't read the second line carefully. Says the Gra in Source 7, Imayalokha belav hachi. What does that mean? Imayalokha belav hachi? If you would have married her, belav hachi, even without this, right, she's a great person who happens to also be wealthy. Ein nikra nosei b'shem mamon. That is not called marrying for money. So guys, there's certainly no argument here that, wealthy girls are off limits because then you're just marrying for money. Okay, but you should be honest, right? If you're marrying her because she's a great person, right, she is not invalid because she's also wealthy. All right. Yeah, Isaac. Yes.
But couldn't they follow their mother and just say, okay, you don't have to marry who you love necessarily. It's not really the same value.
But what do you mean it's not the same value? But apparently halacha does value that you marry who you love.
The value seems to be that you just have to love who you're marrying.
Ah, okay. You're saying maybe you could just develop it. Yeah. What if life's not like that? But you just can't develop love for anybody you haven't been married to.
Is there people who feel otherwise against the marriage?
I'm not aware of anyone who explicitly argues, but the Marek is explicitly accepted halakhically. The Ramah quotes it. Okay? It'll be interesting to find if anybody argues. I'm not aware of somebody argues. Okay, last comment. Josh Gordon.
So there's that idea that if a woman has a bit of rape, and she's still a virgin, the rapist, she can opt in.
Oh, you know, we're not, sorry. Wait, you can't give a break for 2 minutes after my share's over. Okay. Okay, that we'll have to discuss another time also. All right, everybody should enjoy Shabbos here. Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha Ma'ob Yehudim Vesehra Ein Hendra Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha Yeshvei Veitecha.